Chapter 7. The Day After. Gabby followed Susan down a thin path carved through the scrub brush. Although the woman led with her right foot, her left sneaker stamped deeper impressions into the sand, emphasizing the limp that Gabby had previously noted. She wondered if the uneven stride was something new, brought on perhaps by a blister from her beach run or some injury sustained after stumbling upon Rachel's body. The path opened up onto the side of a well-manicured lawn with a sparkling lap pool. The jewel of the property, however, was truly the house. Rhomboid and rectangular panes of glass made up the entire waterfront wall, providing an unobstructed view of the beach and, Gabby reminded herself, the approaching officers. Thankfully, there didn't appear to be anyone watching. Through the windows, she could see straight through to the kitchen, as well as the entirety of the second-floor hallway. The interior was sparsely furnished, leaving clean sight lines. There weren't many places for a grown man to hide other than in the bedrooms. Any guns in the house? Gabby brushed her hand against her hip as though she were adjusting her jacket and not reminding herself of her service weapon. No. Susan's matter-of-fact denial surprised Gabby. Usually, New York suburbanites reacted to the question as though Gabby had asked if there were starving children handcuffed to the basement radiator. Susan's eyes went to the black grip poking out of Gabby's open suit jacket. Please, break the news gently to Ben. Whatever problems he and Rachel had, he can't have done this. Gabby tried to see beneath Susan's apparent nausea and nerves to whatever emotion fueled her continued defense of Rachel's spouse. In Gabby's experience, relationships between heterosexual married couples divided along gender lines, with wives befriending the other women and the husbands making nice with the guys. But the way Susan was acting, it seemed that she cared more about Ben than her dead friend. Where is everyone sleeping? Gabby directed the question at Nadal. He pointed to a tiny balcony with two Adirondack chairs overlooking their position.
Jenny and Lewis have the upstairs bedroom facing the water. Ben is in the downstairs bedroom off the first floor hallway.
Layout provided, Gabby started toward the windowed wall, skirting the lap pool. Before she reached the door, she noticed a red stain on the stone coping. She stopped beside it, then crouched for a better look. The thinness of the crimson smear didn't look like any blood Gabby had ever seen, but she couldn't be sure. She scanned the area for more. About a foot from the blemish were several squashed blades of grass, dyed a thick red. She waved DeMarco over. Tag these, she mouthed. DeMarco pulled a pad of post-its from one of the pouches on his belt and bent beside the two red blotches. That's mine, Susan said as Gabby crouched down. The woman's already wan face seemed to turn green. I was walking around barefoot and cut my heel. A foot injury explained the slight limp, Gabby supposed, though a kick to the back of the leg during a struggle would excuse it as well. She gestured to the round smart lock atop the back door handle. What's the code? Susan reached over Gabby's head to the keypad. As she did, the curly hairs on the nape of Gabby's neck seemed to coil tighter. Susan was certainly tall enough to overpower a woman Rachel's size. 1, 4, 9, 2. Susan paused between announcing each digit, like a lotto worker reading off the winning numbers. She expected, Gabby supposed, that someone would be jotting it down. But none of the officers, Gabby included, wanted their hands occupied with a notebook and pen when entering a strange home, one that more than likely housed a murderer. The door swung back with a whisper, as though nothing stronger than the wind had pushed it open. Gabby's blunt heels were not as subtle. Sharp claps announced every step as she crossed the concrete floor. Officer Kelly's footfall sounded even louder, thanks to his regulation boots.
Gabby expected the noise bouncing between the ceiling beams to call all the house occupants into the main area. Instead, she was greeted with a humid quiet, as if the air were weighed down. Beneath it, she heard the hiss of water rushing through pipes, a steady respiration in the near-silent room.
He could be washing off evidence.
Gabby couldn't distinguish whether DeMarco or Kelly had spoken. Their voices were distorted, muffled by her heartbeat and the blood pounding in her head. Ostensibly, she was just notifying the next of kin, she reminded herself. She needed to calm down. She started toward the first floor hallway, one of the few areas of the home not illuminated by the sun pouring through the windows. As she walked, she waved for DeMarco to tail her with one hand while signaling Officer Kelly to stay back with the other. Water stopped surging through the pipes. The house seemed to hold its breath as both she and DeMarco hustled toward the closed bedroom door.
Hello, Nadal? Is that you? Who's here?
The avalanche of questions tumbled down onto the officers. Gabby spun around to track the motion on the mezzanine. A wiry redhead had stepped into the upstairs hallway. He wore a long-sleeved dress shirt and plaid golf shorts, the picture of a prep school product on vacation. His sun-reddened complexion paled at the sight of the uniformed officer below.
What's going on? Susan? Nadal?
He shouted toward the bedroom door. Louis? Susan shouted up at the second floor.
It's about Rachel.
Louis pivoted toward the door he'd exited moments before.
Jenny, the police are here. Come out.
The police?
The woman's voice sounded high and timid.
If you will come downstairs,
the cathedral ceilings amplified DeMarco's normal speaking voice,
we would like to speak with you.
Louis squinted down at them.
What's this about? We can talk once you're both downstairs, DeMarco said.
A rumbling, like a train rushing down a track, interrupted them. In Gabby's peripheral vision, a door in the hallway slid open. She whirled toward the motion, her right hand reflexively reaching for her Glock's grip. A wall of a man ducked under the door jamb and entered the narrow hallway. In the dim light, Gabby couldn't see his face, but she could estimate his size. 6'5" or 6" and around 240 pounds. Loose gym shorts dangled around his knees, and a white crew neck clung to the lines of his muscular torso, as if wet. He hadn't toweled off from his shower. Mr. Ben Hansen, Gabby hoped she got the name right in spite of her nerves. There'd been so many thrown at her in the past 20 minutes. I'm Detective Watkins. And with me is Detective DeMarco and Officer Kelly. We'd like to talk to you. The massive man placed a hand on the wall, steadying himself while effectively blocking her from passing. He stepped in her direction.
What? What's going on?
His words bubbled out like his brain had not yet fully surfaced from a deep sleep. Gabby stepped back and tapped her fingers against the Glock's handle. Let's go into the living room, where we can sit down. Gabby retreated 2 steps into the great room. She turned to the side, giving Ben an opportunity to pass, and allowing her and DeMarco to subtly flank their suspect. As he emerged from the hallway into the light, Gabby caught the look of confusion marring his clearly handsome face, a face, she realized, that had recently been in a fight. A red bump bulged from the center of Ben's thin bottom lip, making him appear to pout. A purple bruise glowed on his forearm as though it had taken the brunt of a punch.
What's this about?
Lewis's question echoed above her. He was demanding to know what the police were doing in his house.
We'll discuss it down here, sir.
The calm in Gabby's voice relieved her. She didn't sound at all like how she felt.
If you would come down.
Louis stepped toward the staircase. Before he reached the banister, a woman hurried from the open second floor door. The first thing Gabby noticed was her skin, a bronze with a yellow-brown undertone that hadn't come from any self-tanning solution. Black people stood out in the Hamptons because there were so few of them, particularly on the South Fork. Since moving for work, Gabby often went days without seeing anyone that resembled her. Jenny, as the man had called her, appeared to have just woken. Her dark brown hair was uncombed, half curly, with straight pieces falling at the sides. The tee hanging over her leggings looked as though it had been scrunched into a ball. To make up for it, perhaps, she'd thrown a scarf around her neck, as if the red tie somehow made wearing yesterday's clothing French and therefore stylish. Gabby shifted her attention to Lewis. Though he was complying with her demand to descend the stairs, he still exuded arrogance. His head was cocked at a skeptical angle. His lips were pursed in a nervous yet disapproving kiss-off.
"It's Rachel."
Susan's voice sounded even higher and thinner than it had moments before, a violin string about to snap.
"We found her on the beach."
Ben squinted at the wall of windows. "Still? She can't have stayed out all night." Though Ben didn't seem to register Susan's implication, the couple upstairs clearly understood. Lewis's mouth fell open while Jenny clutched her husband's arm.
"But I saw her from the upstairs balcony last night."
Jenny's tinny voice trembled.
"She was on the jetty."
"Come down," DeMarco repeated. "Both of you."
Lewis grasped the railing with his right hand. His left remained in the air as he headed to the first floor, continuing to signal his surrender. Jenny followed him as if on a delay, descending one step to every two taken by her husband. As she reached the middle of the staircase, Gabby saw that the hand gripping the banister was yellowed at the knuckles from the force of her squeezing.
"Rachel?"
Ben called up the staircase where Jenny stood, statue still, several feet from the bottom.
"I saw her from the upstairs balcony last night," Jenny repeated, her voice stronger. "She was sitting on the jetty, watching the ocean."
"What time was this?" Gabby asked.
I don't know. It was night. There were waves, big swells dashing against the rocks. Could she swim?"
Jenny covered her mouth with both hands.
"I'm not sure that she could swim."
Ben's eyes darted from Jenny to Lewis to Jason to Gabby, as though he couldn't discern friend from foe.
"She can swim."
He faced DeMarco.
"She must have gone to a hotel. Did you check the local hotels?"
Gabby didn't know what to make of Ben's reaction. On one hand, he seemed genuinely distraught and discombobulated. But then, he did have a face for acting. Gabby cleared her throat. "Your wife is dead, Mr. Hansen." Ben raked his fingers from his temples down the sides of his cheeks. He looked at Gabby as if she'd failed to understand some self-evident truth.
"No. Susan just said she saw her. And Jenny, we saw her body on the beach, Ben," Nadal said. "I'm sorry."
Ben reached out to grab onto something. He stumbled as his hand clawed air on the staircase's open side. His mouth fell further open, baring his teeth.
"No, no, this isn't right. It can't."
"She was wearing the same swimsuit from last night."
Susan made a hiccuping noise, half gasp, half swallowed tears.
"She didn't respond when we called out to her. Nadal took her pulse."
Ben yelped like an injured animal.
"No, she was right outside. How?"
"We intend to find that out." Gabby stepped beside Ben, asserting her lead of the investigation. "We'll need everyone to come down to the station and tell us when they last saw Ms. Klein, and anything else that you can remember from the prior night."
"But she was just here."
Ben spoke with his hand covering his mouth.
"How could Enough, Ben.
Lewis pointed at the grieving man's chest.
You know how Rachel died. We heard her admit she'd been cheating. We saw how upset you were when you came back from talking to her.
Ben's mouth hung open, showcasing the scabbing back of his busted lip. His eyes widened like a choking victim. Lewis glared at him.
Just admit it. You went back out to that beach. You went out there, and then you killed her.
Chapter 8. The Day of. Jenny placed her purse in the pedestal sink, removing the pill bottles and face creams to unearth her cosmetic bag. She withdrew the tattoo concealer, purchased 6 months earlier to cover a nasty splotch on her shoulder, and then pulled off the top. With the compact in her left hand, she dug in the canvas satchel with her right for the smooth handle of her makeup brush. Finding it, she scraped the bristles across the compact's creamy surface. The hue on the tip reminded her of the custard pies her grandma used to make. Nothing covered a black eye like yellow. She swapped the brush for a foam wedge and patted the color from the purple swath outward over the larger red area, stopping at the welt's chartreuse outline. Jenny fished in the bag for a small bottle of lavender face primer. She pumped a dime-sized amount onto the tip of her pointer finger and massaged it over the bruise's tender edges where the yellow concealer had not touched. The purple lotion dulled the bilirubin-tinted skin into a honey brown, akin to her natural tone. Yellow to blend red and blue, purple to blur green. She finished with a full-color foundation and a setting powder that was supposedly waterproof, though she now doubted it, given the failure to outlast her late afternoon jog. She'd have to be more careful about regularly freshening up in the heat. Jenny examined the results in the mirror, smiling in spite of herself. Practice had improved her cosmetology skills. An intense examination might reveal that the skin beneath the right eye had a grayer undertone than the rest of her face, but no one would see the bruise. A door popped open in the adjoining bedroom. Her semi-pleased reflection vanished from the mirror. In its place stood a stranger with worried eyes and a mouth pulled like guitar wire. Lewis entered with a pouch of ice and tube of arnica cream, the right choice for skin discoloration. Her husband was a good doctor. She had to give him that. He placed the paper towel of ice in the sink beside her bag and then wrapped his arms around her waist, his chin nestled atop her healed shoulder.
I'm so sorry, babe.
Jenny examined her husband's reflection. His fair skin had become so lined since she'd first met him in medical school. There were wrinkles on his forehead, formed from years of punctuating statements with his eyebrows, a pair of lines around his pursed lips, two parentheses highlighting the emotions that he tried to discard, and her favorites, the starbursts that exploded from his half-moon eyes when he was happy or sad, or, like now, concerned. Facial lines told a story, Jenny thought. So many couples traded each other in as that story started to emerge, when they finally knew one another well enough to read each other's faces. Her parents had been that kind of couple, divorcing, despite two kids, simply because they'd become annoyed with one another for aging, resentful of seeing their disappointments etched into their spouse's skin. They hadn't contemplated what would come after their separation, how her mother would entertain guy after guy, none of them interested in settling down with an older woman with children, even if she did look good for her age, nor how her father would suffer a string of divorces, each new woman robbing him of half his wealth until he'd become destitute, relying upon checks from the kids to purchase booze for uninterested barflies. Her folks hadn't cared that the routine they'd found so boring was what had made their children feel secure. They hadn't worried that their kids might grow up feeling alone, uncertain, and abandoned, desperate to recreate the stability they'd once known. She and Lewis were not like her parents. They valued their child and their routine, their shared history. When Jenny stared at Lewis's reflection, she saw the med student with whom she'd worked through organic chemistry and the college kid who had taught her how to ice skate. The young man with whom she'd managed to furnish an apartment on a residence budget. The husband and father who had worked 12-hour shifts and then, as soon as he'd finished his residency, watched a toddler so that she could complete her program. She saw her daughter Allie's lanky body and auburn curls twisted with copper highlights. She saw the love of her life and the man she'd betrayed. It was so easy to convince herself that history didn't matter, that whatever was out there was better than whatever had come before. But seeing her husband, smelling the sandalwood of his familiar aftershave, observing the concern for her in his creased skin, Jenny knew she'd made a mistake. Another man would never measure up to Lewis. She couldn't leave him.
"What can I do for you?"
he asked.
"How can I help?"
She turned from the apparition in the mirror to face the real McCoy. "Nothing. I'm good now." He gave her a smile that failed to crinkle his cheeks. "No, really." She looked into his eyes. Blue, laced with gray, like gathering stratus clouds, and tilted her head. Lewis saw the signal and pressed his mouth to her red lips. Caramel flavors from the whiskey lapped at her tongue. His warm hand slipped under her shirt, grazing her stomach. He kissed her harder as he grasped the blouse's fabric and pulled it upward. She wrenched back. "I just did my makeup, and folks will want dinner soon." Lewis bit his bottom lip and wagged his brows. "Later," she said.
"Promise?"
"Promise. Now go." Jenny pushed his chest. "I need to fix my lipstick." Chapter 9. The Day of. The flat side of the knife was reflecting the late afternoon sun into Nadal's eyes. Susan shifted the cutlery's angle before severing the top of the strawberry in front of her, sending the glare into the center of the deck table. She sliced the fruit into four thin pieces and then scraped them into the metallic bowl overflowing with raw spinach. She was tempted to taste one before dinner was ready, but she fought the urge and grabbed another plump strawberry. Ben had found some decent produce in the farmer's market off the highway. Given the surroundings, she supposed she shouldn't be surprised. Even the backyard where she sat, nestled in the sandy dunes, had a lushness to it. A mossy green lawn, flanked by scrub oaks, surrounded the long pool and small patio. It stopped at a swaying line of ornamental grasses, the green stems morphing into rose-colored plumes, mimicking the ombre of the house's grayed timbers behind her. Beyond it, the sea rushed toward the dunes, the large swells drawing ever closer to the undulating grass. Susan wondered whether it would rain at some point. The air, still humid despite the waning sun, had the heavy feel of a coming storm. It had the smell of one, too. There was a clean odor, as if the atmosphere had been laced with some green herb. The scent mingled with the smell of the lemon Ben had squeezed over the side of halibut roasting atop a foil bed on the grill, beside some husked corn and the baby potatoes she'd quartered. Susan breathed it all in as she resumed cutting the remainder of the strawberries and half listening to Lewis holding court. He was relating an ER story about a man who had come in with an unknown injury. In the short time she'd known Lewis, she'd heard at least half a dozen stories with the same theme. Most were interesting, though they all had the same ending of Dr. Murray saving the day. That was a good thing for all involved, Susan guessed, though it did make Lewis seem a bit of a braggart. As Lewis talked, Susan heard the back door pop open. She looked over her shoulder to see Jenny enter the yard. Even with the sun's amber glare on her neighbor's face, Susan could see that Jenny had freshly applied her makeup. "Hey, everyone," Jenny called out. "Oh, did folks get into bathing suits?" While Jenny had been dealing with her bug bite, they'd all donned swimwear, responding to Rachel's suggestion that they enjoy a soak in the hot tub after dinner. Susan was somewhat relieved that Jenny wasn't wearing her suit. The sporty bikini that Susan had shimmied into no longer fit as well as it had the prior year, and she wasn't eager to shed the sundress she'd layered over it, especially not after eating. Rachel, on the other hand, was clearly itching to get into the hot tub. She wore a white one-piece with a cut-out side that advertised her svelte form, despite the translucent floral kimono hanging open off her narrow shoulders.
"I still need to put mine on."
Lewis waved Jenny over. She walked across the grass to the tiled area where they all sat. Instead of scooting a few inches to make room beside him on the bench, Lewis yanked the belt loop of his wife's shorts, pulling her onto his lap in a playful, possessive way that Susan couldn't help but envy. It had been a while since Nadal had publicly showed the same need to have her physically near.
"I was telling them the detergent story."
Lewis grinned as if the so far tame tale was a bawdy one. Jenny groaned. "Really? Why?"
"It's one of my more amusing ER war stories."
"Horror stories." Lewis kissed the side of her temple.
"It's a good thing you switched to television. You're too sensitive for emergency medicine."
"I just think it's gross."
"I've already started it."
Lewis turned his attention back to Rachel at the head of the table. She sat catty-corner from Nadal, whose shoulder, Susan noted, barely brushed her own, even though he sat beside her.
"So, as I was saying," Lewis continued, "here we all are thinking compound femur fracture because of the way this guy is grasping his thigh through his pants and howling about a hit, you know? The heat, right?"
Susan winced at Lewis's poor Mexican accent, which sounded more like Tattoo from Fantasy Island than anything remotely Spanish. She looked to Jenny to see if she took any offense. Her mouth was tight, either in disapproval or anticipation of a cringeworthy punchline. Susan stopped dicing the strawberry, just in case the conclusion of Lewis's war story was shocking enough to make her slice through her finger.
"So,"
Lewis clapped his hands together,
"we get him on the table and start to cut away his jeans. Sure, we'll see a bone fragment protruding from the leg. Instead, get this, what we see is a third-degree burn. I mean, huge patches of white carved into this guy's thighs. The skin burned through to layers without any melanin. It's awful. And we realize this man's been talking about heat, not a hit."
In the corner of her eye, Nadal's nose flared like he smelled rotting seafood. She tilted the cutting board over the bowl and scraped the remaining fruit into the salad. "That's terrible, poor man." Lewis shrugged, either disagreeing with her assessment or not caring either way.
"We stopped the burning and saved his leg. Ultimately, he had to be transferred to a burn center for recovery. But we got the chemicals off."
"How did he get a chemical burn on his thigh?" Rachel asked. Lewis squeezed Jenny's shoulder.
"Well, that's the funny part. His wife apparently worked as a maid in some hotel. She'd discovered him cheating and coated the inside of his jeans with an industrial-strength alkaline laundry powder."
Lewis suppressed a laugh.
"Sure showed him. If it weren't for his boxer shorts, she would have burned his balls off."
Rachel snickered. Susan followed suit, out of a sense of politeness, despite failing to find the humor in a man nearly losing his leg. Her half-hearted snort clearly wasn't convincing, because Jenny began shaking her head at her husband. "See, you turned everyone's stomach right before dinner." Lewis's stormy eyes shimmered.
"Oh, come on, babe. It's a crazy story. Tarantino couldn't make that up."
Ben frowned and pointed at Lewis with a metal spatula.
"Spousal abuse is a real riot, Lewis. I hope the perpetrator ended up in prison." "Hell if I know."
Lewis stifled another laugh.
"I was busy saving the cheating bastard's leg from amputation."
Rachel rose from the table to grab the near-empty bottle of wine at its center. She tipped it upside down into her glass, adding a swallow to the drop above the stem.
Oh, lighten up, Ben. You should be taking notes for your mystery series.
She gulped the last bit and then smacked her lips together.
I bet that story would fly off the shelves. Death by Detergent by Ben Hansen, inspired by true events. I want a cut,
Lewis laughed.
Well, it would only be fair, Rachel said, smiling. The woman can't profit from her crime, Son of Sam Law. The doctor and his author neighbor, on the other hand. Fish is ready.
Ben pulled the fish off the grill and plated it on a waiting plastic platter.
Hopefully some of you still have an appetite.
Rachel traded her wine glass for the empty bottle.
We should refresh this. What goes with fish? A nice white, right?
She waved the recycling at Nadal.
Help me pick one.
Nadal glanced at his own empty glass.
The California Chardonnays are all fair game. I brought away Burgundy. That's better for later in the week.
Rachel pointed the bottle at Nadal like a rifle, staring down its slender neck.
The fact that you can distinguish between Chardonnay and white Burgundy alone proves that you, sir, should be in charge of picking the bottle for dinner.
Nadal's hand glided atop Susan's own, resting on the cutting board.
Hey, hun, you know the diff. Your wife's busy chopping strawberries, for goodness sake.
Rachel's tone switched from teasing to scolding. Nadal looked down at the bench that he straddled. Reluctantly, he set his whiskey on the table. Rachel's smile stretched into a Cheshire cat grin.
We'll be right back.
Susan watched Rachel strut back to the house with Nadal in tow. Rachel couldn't really need that much help with the wine. Though she might not be able to distinguish between a California Chardonnay and a French Burgundy by taste, Rachel could certainly discern the difference between a label reading Product of California versus one proclaiming Produit de France. So why had she wanted Nadal to come with her so badly? Susan glanced at Ben for clues as to the real reason. He watched his wife re-enter the house, deep-set eyes shadowed by his lowered brow. Was he concerned? Was Rachel trying to make him jealous? Susan silently chided herself for the thought. She'd never make friends if she let her insecurities keep her on the lookout for flirtation. Given her own history, she was probably projecting anyway.
Bring out some balsamic vinegar, too. I think I saw some left in the fridge door.
Susan shouted over her shoulder, keeping her tone nonchalant.
If it's expired, maybe grab the olive oil and mustard Ben bought, and a fork. I can whisk it together with a splash of white wine to make a dressing.
Will do,
Nadal answered. A spinach leaf folded over the edge of the mixing bowl in front of her. Susan plucked the piece from the side and popped it into her mouth. It tasted like green cellophane.
What are the boys doing at camp?
Jenny asked. Susan made eye contact with her, acknowledging the question while pointing to the salad bowl. She covered her mouth with her hand, not wanting to treat her neighbors to the view of mashed spinach undoubtedly between her teeth.
Every sport on the planet for Jamal, including water skiing. Jonah has water skiing and some soccer practice. His camp also focuses on occupational therapies, social interactions, team building, that kind of stuff. It'll be good for him.
Occupational therapy can really work wonders.
Lewis's voice dropped a decibel, as though he were giving her a diagnosis. Susan didn't want to hear one. She plucked another baby spinach leaf from the lip of the bowl, distracting herself from the line of questioning. Someday, she hoped people would ask about Jonah in the same way they inquired about Jamal, focusing on the things he did well and not the ways he could improve.
Do you think you'll keep homeschooling?
Lewis asked. I don't really have another option at the moment. Susan rubbed the spinach stem between her thumb and forefinger, twirling the leaf like a pinwheel. The private schools here won't take a child with an autism diagnosis, and the public school would place him in special education classes, which would be a disaster for him. He's well above his grade level academically,
He just gets overwhelmed from too much stimuli. He can't handle too many strangers or loud noises, but he's working on it. They'd mainstreamed him when we'd lived outside of Redmond. Lewis nodded, his face a mask of seriousness and concern.
Is he taking risperidone?
Susan closed her eyes for a beat so Lewis wouldn't see them roll. The moment he'd started asking about Jonah, she'd known the conversation would turn to medications. Doctors thought pills and scalpels could solve nearly any problem. It makes him very sleepy. She spun the spinach leaf into a blur. He has such an active mind, and we didn't want to sedate it to mush.
Maybe a mild, he's a great kid,
Ben interjected, shutting off the grill's gasoline.
Bright. Will's always saying he'll be first to colonize Mars.
Ben Hansen to the rescue. Again. Susan allowed her eyes to travel up his superhero physique to his chiseled face. She grinned at him. Finally, someone was willing to treat her kid like a human being and not a medical experiment. I'm not used to talking about Jonah's diagnosis with non-family members. She let the leaf tumble to the table. But it's important for our friends to understand so that their kids get where he's coming from and can overlook some of his difficulties to see what he's really great at. I appreciate how nice your children are to him. She looked to Jenny. Allie always waves to him in the backyard and asks about his day. She treats him like a younger kid next door, which he is. She transferred her attention back to Lewis. That's really all he's looking for, all we're looking for. Lewis pulled his thin lips into a tight line. Susan gathered that he wasn't accustomed to his free medical advice not being appreciated. But people, with or without a medical license, needed to understand that her son should be accepted for who he was, not who she or anyone else might want him to be. A broken air seal shattered the tension. Nadal closed the door behind him with his free fingers. He carried a stack of paper plates topped with cutlery in one hand. The other held a wine bottle.
I'm starving.
He dropped everything on the table, save for the Chardonnay. That he placed in the middle like a centerpiece. It had already been uncorked. Had he shared a glass with Rachel inside? Again, Susan admonished herself for worrying about flirting. So what if he had? It didn't matter. What mattered more, she told herself, was that he'd forgotten the dressing. The spinach salad would be inedible without it. That, she told herself, was the reason for the tightness in her chest. Ben glanced toward the back door.
Where's Rachel? She got a call from Chloe, said to start without her.
Ben scratched at the shimmer of gold along his jawline.
Is something wrong?
Nadal settled back into his former seat.
First aid jitters, maybe?
Worry drew down Ben's mouth. He tried to cover it with a forced smile as he brought the fish platter over to the table and sat down on Susan's other side, opposite Jenny.
Be right back. Susan used her husband's shoulder for leverage as she rose. Somebody forgot the dressing.
Rachel was supposed to bring out the rest,
Nadal said. Well, since she's on the call, I'll just grab it. Susan headed toward the house, stopping for a moment at the back door to punch in the lock code. As she entered, she could hear Rachel's voice rising and falling in the hallway.
Who is it, though? Did you see her?
Susan shifted her weight to the pads of her feet before continuing toward the kitchen. There was a harshness to Rachel's tone, reminiscent of how Susan sounded right before she shouted or started mentally ticking off the minutes until 5 o'clock happy hour. She knew better than to interrupt the person making that voice.
What do you mean you didn't see her? You saw the kiss, didn't you? How could you really not see her face?
Rachel sounded even louder in the kitchen. Susan could hear her pacing on the other side of the wall, her sandals slapping the concrete floor. Susan opened the pantry door like it was the electrical panel of a bomb, pulling it back a centimeter at a time to avoid it squeaking.
All right. No, honey, you're right. I don't mean to get upset with you. I'm not upset with you. I'm glad that you told me. You were right to do that. It's just upsetting to hear.
A stuttering inhale penetrated the wall. Susan froze, with her hand wrapped around the dark bottle of balsamic. Was Rachel crying? Did Rachel do that?
Everyone did, under the right circumstances, Susan supposed, though she couldn't imagine what those circumstances might be for a woman that seemed to have it all. Healthy children, handsome husband, high-powered career that even helped people. She grabbed a bottle of olive oil and began looking for a small glass dish to whip her dressing in, excusing her eavesdropping as a desire to be of use. If Rachel needed someone, she could offer a listening ear. Being there for someone when it was uncomfortable or difficult was the difference between friendliness and real friendship.
You think she's a mom at school or just in town?
Uh-huh.
So, you've never seen her at any of your school events?
Maybe.
Well, what is it, Chloe? Is it that you don't want to tell me?
Rachel's voice raised to a decibel below a shout.
No, I know. I'm sorry. I love you. I love you so much. You know that, right, honey? This isn't about you. It's about your father.
The back door slammed shut. Nadal strode into the room, an annoyed look on his face. Susan grabbed a glass dish and closed the cabinet door.
Sorry, it took forever to find this balsamic.
She said it more for Rachel's benefit than to give Nadal an excuse for her delay. Nadal went to the cabinet by the wine fridge.
I should probably bring out a few more wine glasses, too.
Susan squirted the balsamic atop the pale green oil she'd poured into the glass bowl. As she did, she gestured with her head to the wall. Instead of Rachel's voice, she heard the harsh rumble of someone pulling the sliding bedroom door.
Rachel's crying,
Susan mouthed. Nadal's eyebrows pinched together. He shook off the expression and resumed grabbing glasses from the cabinet.
Should I?
Nadal interrupted her murmured question with a sharp shake of his head. He started toward the back door.
People are waiting to eat. Let's go before the food gets cold.
Chapter 10, The Day After. The police station had only two interview rooms. After fingerprinting all the house guests, ostensibly to rule out any prints not belonging to Rachel's unknown assailant, Gabby told Detective DeMarco to place Ben Hansen in Interrogation 1. The room was a closet-sized space with gray walls, grayish carpet, two chairs, and a single slate-colored table bolted to the floor. The desk had two handles on it for cuffing suspects to the furniture, though the detectives didn't typically advertise that fact to visitors without bracelets. Gabby figured she might mention it to Ben. Since Lewis had publicly accused him of murder, there was little point pretending that he wasn't a prime suspect. He'd be anticipating a grilling. She might as well show him just how hot the fire could get. She led the other couples to the soft interrogation room. A homely space, it had been modeled after a family sitcom set in hopes of putting victims and their loved ones at ease. The room contained a taupe couch and a floral easy chair, probably picked up at an estate sale. The walls were non-threatening neutrals. Gabby didn't plan to interview the neighbors as a unit, but she did think it all right, perhaps even beneficial, to leave them as a group under the glare of Officer Kelly and a mounted camera. If they talked about the case, she'd have everything recorded. Gabby pulled back the door and waved the foursome inside, hanging back to watch how they chose their seats. Lewis entered first, holding his wife's hand. He led Jenny to the sofa, subtly guiding her to the inside seat against the armrest, furthest away from Officer Kelly's position by the door. As Jenny assumed her designated place, she hung her head low so that her hair fell into her face. Lewis stood beside his wife, partially blocking her from view, as Nadal and Susan perched on the opposite side of the couch, When they sat, Susan leaned into her husband as though she might not be able to hold herself up. He put his arm around her shoulder and squeezed her to his side.
"We would appreciate if you all would stay here while we talk to Mr. Hansen," Gabby said. "I will be back shortly to answer as many questions as I can."
Lewis stood straighter.
"You're not going to let Ben come back to the house with us, are you? He's a murderer."
Gabby held up a hand. "If there is any evidence to support that Ben hurt Rachel, he'll be arrested. But we have to talk to him first."
Lewis patted his wife's shoulder, apparently satisfied by the statement. Jenny shuddered at the touch, or perhaps at the possibility that she'd been sleeping in the same house as a murderer. She adjusted the bizarre scarf around her neck so that it covered nearly to her chin. Gabby made eye contact with Officer Kelly and then glanced up to the corner of the room with the camera, reminding him they would be recording all interactions. He followed her gaze a little too obviously, though without eliciting an apparent reaction from the group. Lewis was, thankfully, still gazing at Jenny's lowered head, and Susan's face was nearly buried in her husband's side. Only Nadal was staring at the officers as though anticipating his coming interview. As she pushed the door shut, Gabby's phone vibrated against her leg. She checked the caller ID while striding down the linoleum hallway to interrogation one. Bay was calling. In spite of the seriousness of her circumstances, Gabby felt a smile crack her stern expression. She'd altered the nickname for her husband several weeks earlier to tease her daughter, who'd been using the moniker to refer to the baby-faced ball player who had escorted her to junior prom. As Derek often joked, "Teenagers, if you can't beat them, and you really can't nowadays, mortify them."
"Hey, Deuce." Gabby had called her husband by that nickname since high school, when he'd been on the baseball team playing under the number two. As terms of endearment went, it wasn't much more mature or original than Kayla's Bay, but she'd chosen it at 18, and it had stuck. Derek had even had the number tattooed on his bicep. "What's up?
When you getting home tonight?"
Gabby felt her smile fade as she strode down the hallway. "The way things are going, I'll be lucky to make it home at all. A woman was found dead on the beach this morning. It's looking like murder." The speaker crackled with Derek's exhale.
"Man, okay then, we'll discuss it later."
Gabby stopped walking. Summer was the busy season for Derek's landscaping company. He wouldn't have called her in the middle of the day to talk unless it was important. "What's up? Did something happen with Kayla or Dan?" A heavy sigh confirmed her suspicion. Gabby felt the surge of motherly panic that always accompanied phone calls about her kids. Police work had made her hyper-aware of the threats to women, particularly young ones who pretended to act grown like Kayla, as well as the dangers of binge drinking, which college sophomores like Daniel were apt to do. "What happened?"
"Don't worry. I don't want to bother you while you're dealing with all this. Just know that Kayla is fine and under house arrest. We can discuss appropriate sentencing later."
The panic receded. Kayla was home, and Derek was handling it. No doubt their daughter had lied about something boy-related. Derek had always been strict when it came to dating and curfews, but he was particularly so with Kayla, allowing her only on group dates to public places. Her husband remembered too clearly how he'd gotten Gabby pregnant the summer before her freshman year of college, leading her to defer acceptance to the University of Michigan and, ultimately, withdraw. Gabby resumed walking. "She went on a solo date or something?"
"Remember how she said she was going to Zoe's house? I found her at this party."
Derek's voice rose on the other end of the line, his anger at their daughter's lie returning.
"But don't worry, you have enough on your plate. We'll talk later. Love you."
She turned left from the hallway into the room of gray cubicles and computer screens where the detectives filled out their paperwork. The door to Interrogation 1 was at the end of the room, closed and locked like a jail cell. Derek was right. She had to focus on the possible murderer behind that door and not her teen's latest indiscretion. All right, later. And love you too. Gabby pulled back the door. Ben sat behind the bolted desk, positioned perpendicular to the exit. The handlebars for the cuffs flanked his free hands. His eyes were bloodshot, even more so than earlier. Gabby thought his split lip looked worse, too, as though he'd reopened the wound by chewing on it. She glanced at the camera mounted in the room's far corner, above the edge of a one-way mirror facing the desk. The camera sent a live feed to the adjacent room where Detective DeMarco sat behind a television-sized monitor, watching the proceedings that he could also see live by gazing through the window. They'd agreed that she'd take first crack at Ben. If her tactics didn't get him talking, DeMarco could relieve her. Mr. Hansen. Gabby assumed the seat across from him, adjusting it so she wouldn't directly block DeMarco's view. Obviously, your neighbor made some pretty serious accusations earlier that we need to discuss. Ben folded his hands together.
It wasn't like Lewis said.
Well, let's get this over with then, so you can tell me what he got wrong. You have the right to remain silent. Your custody officer has informed you of your Miranda rights, correct? Ben rolled his eyes. You have to speak aloud for the camera. Do you understand these rights? Ben looked over her shoulder to where the camera was positioned.
Yes, I understand my rights.
Gabby shifted in her chair, turning slightly sideways so that her legs wouldn't brush Ben's far longer ones. You understand your rights, good. Now, tell me about this argument with your wife.
Lewis is lying about me going back to the beach.
Ben leaned over his folded hands.
He started the whole fight, actually. Maybe that's why he's saying these things. He's angry that—
Gabby held up a palm. An interrogation was not an exchange of information between equals. She couldn't let Ben settle into storyteller mode and ramble on about some beef he'd had with the neighbor. It was necessary to interrupt him, throw off his rhythm. How did the fight start? Ben mashed his lips together.
I don't know. Jenny had something on her face that—
Ben ran his right hand over his forehead.
It doesn't matter. The point is, I didn't hurt my wife. I would never have laid a hand on Rachel or any woman.
He looked directly at her, dark blue eyes pulling like a riptide.
I am not an abuser.
Gabby shrugged. I don't know what you are, Mr. Hansen, but I know what your neighbors think you did. They say you got into a public argument with your wife. One devastating enough for her to run out to the beach by herself and stay there for hours. Afterward, you went out to talk to her, and she sent you away. Then you tried again.
No, I didn't. Lewis doesn't know anything.
Ben leaned farther over the table.
I went out once to talk to Rachel a bit before midnight when Lewis and Susan saw me. I left my wife alive on that beach. I swear, I'll take whatever lie detector test you need to prove it.
Gabby motioned for him to settle back down into his seat. Where did you go after talking to her?
I drove to a bar called Farrow's Place, down the block, had a drink.
How long were you there? Ben's eyes shifted from her.
I don't know.
Gabby settled back into her chair as though I don't know were a completely acceptable murder alibi. Well, that's all right. I can check with the bartender there and the traffic cam in front of the place. I'll see how long you were at that bar and if you left soon after arriving. It won't look good for you if you did, though. It'll seem like you were trying to create an alibi. It'll seem like you planned everything. Ben made a grunting sound, like he'd been tackled to the ground. You know that saying, intent is 9/10 of the law, Gabby continued. There's some sympathy for a crime of passion. Husbands and wives argue. Emotions run high.
Sometimes things get out of hand. I'm married. I get it. Premeditated murder, though. Gabby winced as though she could see the dirty prison cell Ben would soon be occupying. That's life imprisonment without parole. Even the death penalty. New York still has one, you know.
I didn't hurt my wife,
Ben said firmly. Gabby gestured to his split lip. How did you get that?
He shook his head. You don't know again? That's okay. I have a theory.
Your wife admitted during the course of an argument in front of your friends that she was sleeping with someone else. You went out to talk to her, maybe get her to apologize and beg your forgiveness, but it didn't go that way. So you walked off, hoping to calm down. Maybe you even went to the bar, thinking a drink would take the edge off. But it didn't. She'd slept with someone else. That's a huge betrayal. I get it. So you went back out there to really lay into her. And things got out of hand. Gabby pointed at Ben's puffy bottom lip. Maybe she popped you in the mouth and you saw red. Maybe she was defending herself.
I didn't hit my wife.
Ben's shout broke his composure. Sobs shook his broad shoulders.
I was in the bar for 20 minutes. Some Irish college girl started chatting me up. Said there was a party.
He rubbed his hands over his reddened cheeks.
I shouldn't have gone, but I was thinking, well, if my marriage is over, then what's stopping me?
Ben puffed his cheeks and exhaled. The blood rushing to his face gave him a boozer's complexion.
I get to the party and start drinking. About an hour in, I'm talking to this attractive woman. She's young, but I'm thinking 21 at least. Next thing I know, this guy, almost as big as me, is grabbing my arm and throwing a punch, shouting that she's 16. He's threatening to have me thrown in jail for serving minors, like it was my party.
The flush on Ben's face deepened.
My daughter's 13, so I get where he was coming from. But this girl didn't look her age, I swear.
Gabby felt her tongue start to protrude from between her lips, the way it often did when she was puzzling out a connection. Mariel had told her about two men fighting at a party and a man threatening to call police about underage drinking. It seemed Ben had gone to the